Hello, hello. This is Chris, seafarer turned designer.
And this is Carl, nurse turned designer. Welcome to Design Shifters,
a podcast on how people shift to design. Hello, hello. Welcome, Sir Oj. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad you chose me to be one of your speakers.
We're so glad that you accepted our invitation, Sir Oj. And to our listeners, we would like to introduce you to you, Sir Oj Hofer, our teacher, our mentor, when we were doing our master's in Applied Arts and Design at UP.
Yeah, first of all, I'm very ecstatic for our guest for today because he's one of the established name in fashion industry in the Philippines, not just in Cebu. So that's one of the highlights of the show, really, to bring in experts in different fields in design and like let them share their journey on how they break into the industry, and you can probably learn a lot from him.
Hopefully, I'll be able to impart some nuggets of wisdom and some advice to your listeners.
Exactly. To those who doesn't know you yet, sir, can you briefly introduce yourself?
Okay, so my name is Oj Hofer, and I've been designing for, I can't remember how many decades, maybe 30, because I started designing in 1987, 88, yes, and... very bad with math, obviously. So I'm good with design, but bad with math. So my primary job is really designing clothes. And I've tried ready-to-wear before, but the market wasn't ready yet. So now I'm just focusing on made-to-order clothes. So specific garments for special occasions and for men and women. I also... teach art because I graduated from UP Diliman College of Fine Arts, so I have a bachelor's degree in fine arts and visual communication, so particularly editorial design. So when I came to Cebu, initially I was working as a designer but also doing fashion editorship for Z Lifestyle magazine. So that's how I was able to apply what I learned in school. And with regards to fashion designing, I took some fashion courses in UP Diliman, but that wasn't my focus because I was supposed to be working in an ad agency. But I came through Cebu. I had work waiting for me in Manila. I came through Cebu. I said, I'm going to stay for maybe 2 weeks, like that. And when I came, my cousin, who is now the governor of Sambong and Cebu guy, she was then, we were fresh out of college then in 1987, 88, and she told me, why don't you just stay, you know, for a couple of years, let's open a fashion house and try to see if you like it. So I said okay, because I loved Cebu. It was compared to Manila, which was very so much traffic and we had floods and all that. Cebu was like heaven, you know. The beach was very near, and I like the people also. So I said to myself, I'll do 3 years of designing clothes, and then I'm gonna go back to art because that was really what I wanted to be, become an artist to do you know, paintings and graphic arts. But then I stayed on, so here I am today.
Still like doing. From 3 years to 30 years.
yes. So, and then enjoying every single day of what I'm doing.
That's very interesting. I just want to double down on, you mentioned about you want to delve into graphic arts. When did you realize fashion design is your path moving forward?
Actually, you know, when I was starting, I was, how do you say it? I didn't look at fashion designer as designing as a career, because my training really was the visual arts, you know. And I was trained to do. We didn't have Photoshop then, so we had to do the traditional and no digital cameras. So I knew how to work in the dark room.
Wow.
Yeah. So photography was, everything was so classic. So when I started to move to Cebu, it was like I said, I'm gonna give myself 3 years to do this. You know, if I enjoy it, go ahead. I'll go ahead. But if I didn't, then I'll go back to what I was really trained for, because my bachelor's degree was a full trade. You know, it was. I had the best teachers in UP, Diliman, by the way. So, but I also enjoyed fashion. But it was, for me, it wasn't a career in the beginning. But then, as I started to enjoy what I was doing, it became that. Because when we opened the shop in 1987 or 88, we invited Cebu's 200, the top ladies of Cebu. We opened with a fashion show by flying in models from Manila. And Tweety De Leon had just won the Supermodel of the Philippines competition during that time. So we did the first, and the show was here in our garden. Wow. We had a garden show. We invited Cebu's 200, and we also invited all of Cebu's top designers so that, you know, I could establish friendships with them. Yeah, so that's what we did. And somehow it was effective because we had a client base. Not everyone came back for clothes, but a good 50% came back to have the clothes made because we introduced ourselves.
Yeah, it somehow like set your name in front of the people, right? Like,
yes, because we really knew who we had a target market in mind. We were going into made to order business, so we wanted the ladies who lunched. You know, the ladies in Cebu who could afford to, you know, who dressed up, who went to parties and dressed up, and who were clients of designers. My cousin, she was herself a person who had clothes made. She would go to the designers here, and she was very fashionable. So earlier on, she was already exposed to made-to-order business.
So, in regards to that, Sir Oj, can you tell us, like, what were the, you know, early days of fashion? What was that like here in Cebu?
You know, there were no malls yet. There was only Rustans. Yeah, there were no malls. So, as a matter of fact, a lot more people went to have their clothes made because they didn't really have Zara or Forever 21, H&M,
right? Like, it's like RTW. Everyone can just go to the mall and buy one.
Then, back then, people would even have casual clothes made or office clothes made. They would come to have some shirts and suits made. But now, because of the proliferation of all the brands, yes, you have those brands. And then, you know, because it's RTW, so it's easier. When you need it quick, then you have an easy cure. But before, you had to wait long. So the waiting time, some girls would find it, we're not used to that. So I eventually had to transition from making casual clothes into just focusing on evening clothes. So when the malls opened, I also tried to do ready-to-wear, by the way. So Ayala opened just about 2 years after it opened. I did RTW, but then the traffic in Ayala was, you know, meager. So we didn't have enough clients, and, you know, we had to pay rent. So after a year and a half, I said, oh, let's just close. Let's just fold. After 2 years.
What year was this?
You know, I can't remember, but it was the second year that Ayala opened. Yes.
It's like 1978, probably.
Yeah, so it was a long time ago. And I was doing clothes for working women because I already had an inkling that, you know, they'll stop coming to me for their office clothes. They'll probably come to me for formal clothes and bridals and, you know, like that. So, but somehow, because I wasn't used to that, I had never had experience working in an RTW business in Manila. And so, yeah, so I didn't know how to run it. So we closed it and I just focused on made-to-order.
How was the competition, sir, during that time? Like, are there other fashion designers on the same industry that you're playing?
Yes. So there were most of the people I invited had already passed on. So these were the senior designers. There weren't a lot. Like right now, maybe you have 40, 50 designers, young designers, and established designers in total. I just did a show in Waterfront Hotel. It was a bridal show, and there were 25 designers. I said, you know, oh my goodness, that much designer. And during that time, when I started, there were about 15. Mm-hmm. Because we had an organization, Cebu Fashion Designers Guild, and, you know, and so I can actually count in my two hands the ones that were really, you know, to go to designers. So Philip Rodriguez, for example, had always been there. Philip Rodriguez, and then some of the designers moved to Manhattan and worked there as, you know, still in fashion on Fifth Avenue. And I would see them there. I would visit them because they became my friends. But the ones who got left behind, oh my goodness. Felix Yu is gone. He was one of the senior ones who was really creative. Felix Yu. He was like a pillar of Cebu fashion, Cebuano fashion. Yeah, so Felix Yu. And then the female designers were, they were always female designers, right? So RC Gayatin is stopped designing. She's already in Chicago now, but she was one of them, the ones that started, who were the ones who was really established. And, you know, some more designers. Yeah. So there, yeah. So, but now the numbers have increased and a lot of the young ones, I see them, I recognize them by face and sometimes by name, but you know, I can't really, I don't really know what their work is like. Mm. Unlike before where I have a specific, you know, I know she's doing this and Philip's very good at this and June Ascario is still around, but, and he's doing very well. Doing this, you know, we had looks, specific looks. Right now, I can't tell because, you know, there's too many designers.
So currently, so like compared to what was the industry before and now, like how easy would it be, or for you, like as if there was a, let's say, a new designer or someone who wanted to go into fashion design, would it be right now easier to go into fashion design knowing that, as you said, like there's so many fashion designers right now compared to before? Or like what's the difference of, what you call, in terms of career as a fashion designer, what was the difference before and today?
I think it's much easier to become a fashion designer these days or to make a shift from another creative field. It's because we have, mainly because we have schools already. We have institutes for fashion. When I started fashion design, I had to go through, I took some courses in Manila, clothing technology, and I had a professor from Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, and I joined competitions, and the competitions gave me scholarships. So I was exposed to French teachers, and this is how, and this was for building the foundation of fashion design, because you can't just sketch a dress and call yourself a designer. I think you will be very good as an illustrator. And fashion illustration is all a business. It's all a genre on its own. But in Cebu, before, I think there were less fashion designers because, well, there were less people, of course. So the market was smaller. But since it expanded and there were schools that opened, so more people had the chance to learn the basics, construction and all this. Because really, you can't call yourself a designer if you're just sketching. You have to know the basics.
It's probably the difference between like an architect and a draftsman, something like that. Like
yes,
if you can just draw, then maybe you're drawing a house. But all the things that you have to integrate into building a very good dress is like in the head of the fashion designer. Like it's just not being shown like on the output. Like the hard work is being done by the fashion designer.
Yeah, initially when I started, what attracted me was the process of creating clothes. It wasn't the money, right? Because the process of creating clothes to me, because coming from an art school, was like sculpture. So I mold the dress on a human form. So that's how, you know, I think it was a crazy idea, but I stuck to it because even to this day, when I make something for a client, a lady, So I look at her first because she's the most important thing. So if you come to me, for example, you're the most important element of the interaction.
Yeah.
The clothes follow after you. So sculpting it around you. You have to be there for me to create something. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And I think that was maybe my Waterloo in creating ready-to-wear, because I'm not good in creating a fictional client, you know. Yeah, so you have to be there for me to see how do I enhance your assets and somehow take away the eye from the flaws of your body or whatever or what you feel that you need to conceal, right? So there's always an interaction, and the client is the most important aspect of fashion designing.
So interesting, because like in design, we always think of, like, for example, we're doing user experience design, we're thinking about human-centered design, but we never think of fashion as like, you need to think about who will wear it. Like, so, because right now we're so used, like the us in our in what we see right now, because we're so used with RTW, right? Like, you can just buy clothes. But from what we've learned, like what you said, like, the most important is actually the person, the human in there, because you're creating something for that human to be to use, and you're creating it for them. Not really, you're not creating a dress, but you're creating something for that human to use. So it's very human centric in a way, because you need to know that person, maybe even the character of that person.
Exactly,
probably, right?
And that's how it becomes. That's how you establish the rapport. That's how you establish their trust, particularly in made-to-order clothes. When you know the person already, and you have transcended the physicality of the person, right? So then the person trusts you and just tells you, okay, just make me this. And then you can sketch anything because you're already guided. But initially, you really have, because we're all humans, right? So we're designing for the human body and for a human person. So when I'm designing for a mannequin, it's so different. Because a mannequin can have perfect proportions, and that's what we do in ready-to-wear. We have an imaginary, we do the statistics you do a database of all the body forms, you do the average. But how many people can fit into that average, right? Yeah. So some people have short torsos, some guys have thin legs and big upper body. So you would have a large shirt with small pants, right? So but it works because you get to see the product right there. So that's how it works. But there's also a lot of wastage.
Yeah.
Right? Because what happens to the ones that don't get chosen? So in a way, I would say that the made-to-order business is really the more humane compared to RTW because of how it affects the environment.
Yeah. Right? Mass fashion does affect the environment very much.
Very, very, very hard impact on the environment. The dyeing requires so much water, and the chemicals that go into the water really destroys the ecosystems. And the plastics, the waste that comes from clothes, because we use a lot of polyester. Mm-hmm. Polyester is synthetic, and it contributes to the clogging up of waterways and that island of plastic in the Pacific.
I want to go back on the topic of designing specifically to the person, right? What do you call this one? Who are the people you have already designed for, or you dressed for?
Okay.
This one, like, if it's okay to name drop, who was the someone or person that you can say, like, so easy to work with?
Easy to work with would be this lady from the street who just wants a dress made and who wants to see me for a dress made. That would be a very easy person. If it's somebody who's very in Bisaya you call it kutihan, it's very meticulous, then it's there comes a time when I have to say, maybe you should go to my friend because he specializes on this. this particular look. Like, because I say that you have to think of the person before the design, right? So, but sometimes a person doesn't know what's good for her. So you try to guide and you try to make them realize what their assets are, right? But sometimes they can't get over some, you know, some perceptions of themselves, and they want to be in full control of the design. So it doesn't become a conversation anymore.
It
becomes one way. So when it's one way like that, then the best thing to do is go to a sewer, because the sewer can do exactly as you want, right? And you're paying the designer not only for the design, but for the time that he come to visit, right? And for the designer's time to fit you, because when I fit, that's part of the deal. It takes time for me to fit the client to perfect the clothes. So if I do three fittings, two fittings, one fitting, or three fittings, then, you know, that's part of the whole thing. That's why made-to-order is more costly than ready-to-wear. Ready-to-wear, you pick it up, it's done. You don't like it, don't wear it. Made-to-order, you want it adjusted, we have to adjust it. That's why we have to perfect it in one fitting.
Sir, how do you discover your style? Like, of course, every designer has their own thumbprints, their own signature.
My style.
Right. Yeah.
My style is no style. I go for form and structure instead of decoration, instead of embellishment. So, in cases where I have to embellish, I make sure that the form and the structure is already perfect. Then I do the embellishment. And also, I do the story. So if it's embellished, I won't put just anything there. It has to be part of the design. There's an integral, it's an integral part of the whole. So yeah.
Everything is intentional.
Intentional or not, yes, you can say intentional, but everything is an integral part of the whole. Yeah, so there's no accident. Like because sometimes when you make a mistake, like some I notice some designers, when they make a mistake with the fit, they cover it with applique. They cover it with things that, you know, conceal it. But I try to avoid it in the first place, so that I don't have to put those things that cover it anymore. I didn't want to really go into the details of the clientele, but I have worked with different people, so from past like the past president, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. So when she was still president, her stylist was my classmate from UP Diliman. So she asked me to go to Malacañang and take the measurements and provide wardrobe for her, because it's how they work. They do you design 10 to 20 pieces. And then they give you a schedule to deliver it, and then a schedule to fit it first. So if you fit, and then in 20 minutes or 30 minutes, you're in and out of Malacañang, getting the fit, perfecting the fit. So I've worked with clients like that, and I think that demands discipline, because you really have to finish. You have to have a timetable. And the ones that are easy to work with are the ones who give you time, who give you a timetable, who give you enough time. So the worst clients for me are the clients who will tell you, "Can you do this in 2 days?" Yeah, because you know, RTW is there, so just go to them. But sometimes they'd want something like that. So but I weeded that out already through the years. I was able to weed it out. So I don't have clients like that anymore who expect something spectacular. I normally work for 2 weeks. So come, if you give me something simple to do, in 2 weeks it'll be ready. But if it's more complicated, then, you know, it becomes can go to a month. And even wedding gowns can take 6 months. Depends on how intricate it is, because some clothes require embellishment, which comes only after, like I said, comes only after the fittings.
You've been talking about your design philosophy. Can you tell us more about it?
Okay, so my design philosophy is it's really simplicity. I try to make everything simple because simple things last a long time. I pose this question to myself. Is it clean? Is it clear? Will it last? Will it endure? So what endures normally are things that are simple and are functional. Mm. Things that are embellished and are superfluous tend to fade away. So this has its roots in Buddhism, because I practice Buddhism. I practice Mahayana Buddhism and Chan, to be specific, Chan, which is Zen in Japanese. So in Zen, you have to be in the moment. So when I design, I have to be in that moment of designing. And when I'm crafting my clothes, it's not just in Mahayana Buddhism, the practice of meditation is your everyday life. It's not just seated. So when I'm doing my clothes, I'm meditating. When I'm cutting the pattern, I'm actually meditating. I'm focused on the task and so even my breathing is relaxed. Even the mechanics of my, the body, what do you call it? The body mechanics is relaxed. So I teach that even to the people I work with, when they're working, shoulders have to be relaxed. They shouldn't be in a stooped position. And the spine is and this translates in my clothes because the clothes are mostly simple. You know that it's probably made by my hands or by the shop where I work. If you see the starkness of the clothes, but it's a starkness that hides a lot of techniques.
Yeah.
Right, so because the hardest dress to make would be a white shift dress, a simple white dress, because you have to consider how to keep it white at the end of the process, the start all the way to the end. How do you keep a white dress white? Because you have to fit it, right?
Yeah.
So bridal gowns for me are the hardest to make because they're not only white, they're also elaborate. So they have to be. You have to put something special, which will make the bride happy. Mm. And also, my philosophy has always been. I've given you a glimpse of it when I said it's the client first. So when I make the clothes, it's not really for profit. That's not the point of making clothes for me. Maybe there was a time when I was just thinking of profit, because I have, after all, I have people to pay, the sewers and bills to pay. But I've gone beyond that, and it's really to give give something to the client. So more than the dress itself is the joy of wearing it, the ease of wearing it. And for me it's very important that the client's at ease when she's wearing the clothes. So if you have if you see a woman who's constantly fixing her dress, then there's something wrong with the dress. There's something wrong with the intention of the person who made that dress. Because if your intention is to make that person happy, then you do everything before the person wears it so that it's perfect for her. And she won't be worrying about, how to keep the dress up or how to walk so that she doesn't step on the gown, on the length, right? So that's what happens when you take the person first. You think of the client first. You do everything so that the client becomes happy in her dress. And then I also push that a little bit more by visualizing. So I have a practice of visualizing the client before I even start making the dress. So after we've spoken and I feel that I can give something to the client, then I visualize the client happy in that dress already. So the dress hasn't been made, but the initial intention is already there, that she's wearing the dress and she's happy. And somehow it worked. It worked for me. It worked. So that's really my formula when I make the clothes.
It's like form follows function. designing for function first, then the form part comes along the way.
Yeah, well, it's the harmony of form and function. It's really the harmony, because function cannot come without the form, and form cannot be achieved without the function. So in design, there's such a thing as harmony of principle and phenomena. So the principle of making a chair has to have four legs, a seat, and a back of the, that's the principle. Now the phenomena is the actual chair. Does it look like that? Does it have four legs? Okay. So principle and phenomena. Same with the dress. The principle that I'm putting in the dress is I want a simple line that will enhance her person. I'll make a dress that will make her happy. That's the principle behind it. Now, the phenomena is, am I able to execute it so that she's happy? So that she's functioning well, and so that she's, you know, she can turn in her dress, or if it's a winter coat, stay warm in her dress.
Interesting.
Right. So there has to be harmony. Otherwise, if there's a discord, then it's bad design. Good design is something that doesn't look obviously designed. So it looks like it's in its natural state.
But you said like it's in harmony with
everything.
It's like so zen.
Like Buddhism, yeah. Harmony of the mind and soul.
Yes.
Zen, yin and yang.
I don't know if that's what yin and yang.
Yin and yang is always, but yes, the harmony of yin and yang, it completes it, makes the whole.
Yeah.
It makes the whole.
So to what extent do you integrate Buddhism in your practice as a designer or in your inner style?
In my style. So Buddhism is a way of life. So it's everywhere. In everything that I do, it's there. Because the intention really is there. The intention to give joy, give confidence, or, you know, give confidence, give hope. Those are tenets of Buddhism that I practice. So even in my work, even in dealing with people, and what I practice is humanistic Buddhism. Mm. So humanistic Buddhism is very interesting because you pointed out earlier, we were talking about, I have to design for a human, not a mannequin, right? So humanistic Buddhism is just that. You focus on humans and how to have good affinities with human beings. And then you extend that outwards, it becomes Mahayana Buddhism, which is all sentient beings, including animals and the germs and bacteria.
I think we should shift to another region. I do believe Buddhism or religion in some way is very humanistic.
It has taken a shift into humanism, because earlier on, even I came from a Jesuit school. I studied in Ateneo in Davao. I came from Ateneo, and we were under the Jesuits. So I know a little bit of the history of Catholicism and Christianity, where in the beginning it was the church that had all the power. And eventually, humanism came in, and the focus of instead of how do I get to heaven, how do I become a good person and enter heaven, it shifted to how do I become a good human being. So instead of focusing in the afterlife and how the dead, you know, how the dead people are, you focus on how am I now?
Yeah.
What am I to do now? So humanism came in, and it gave birth to humanities, which is the study of, and also art and all these things. So yeah, so humanistic Buddhism, and I think is something that relates to everything I do. So when I do the flower arrangement, the purpose of making a flower arrangement is to give joy to the viewer. It's not an expression of how I feel at this. No, it's not. It's to give joy to the viewer, so that when a viewer catches a glimpse of the flower, then it will refresh the viewer, and the viewer will feel, oh, how nice it. You know, the green will put her at ease, and even with so everything I do has that element to it. It's not selfish, because in Buddhism there is no self. Okay. It's connectivity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I'm connected to you. You're connected to me. Like that. You cannot.
Oneness.
It's oneness and connectivity. So that's why.
We should do another, you know, discussion about Buddhism. It's very interesting, especially design and Buddhism, or the philosophy of Buddhist philosophies of oneness, non-duality, and all that stuff.
Actually, it's influenced a lot. Buddhism has influenced a lot of design schools. Take, for example, wabi-sabi. Are you familiar with wabi-sabi?
Yeah, the Japanese.
So the Japanese aesthetic of finding perfection in imperfection, finding beauty in decay. So, whereas the Western would look beauty as symmetry, something that's polished, something that's intricate, something that's maybe manicured. But on the opposite spectrum would be wabi-sabi, which finds beauty in the natural state of things. So if a gate, a steel gate, is decaying and it's in its tattered form, and you saw it and you found beauty in that, that's wabi-sabi. It's not just seeing the perfect, not seeing beauty in the perfect, seeing beauty in, you know, in something that's not normally considered beautiful.
Yeah. So, and I think that's more realistic, right? When you go out in the world, it's not really very polished. When you look at outside, it's like there's always some imperfections in there, and there's there's grass, dead leaves on the floor.
Yes.
There are cracks in there. So for me, I find that beautiful also. And that's where me and my parents differ, because they always like the very polished.
Like, right.
Shiny. Clean, shiny. And
shiny.
Like, I like this crack. I like this rust here and all that stuff.
Yeah, so very funny. I did a painting exhibit in 2019, just before the pandemic. And guess what the first painting was that sold? I just painted cracks, you know, using the brush, the Japanese brush and ink. So I had a long paper. I just painted cracks, and that was the first thing that sold.
Wow! And I think I'm not surprised with that, because that aesthetic and the person who saw that probably understood what it was.
Exactly,
right?
But it came as a surprise to me because I didn't expect people to be ready for that. I thought that because I've always been to exhibits and all that, and I see a lot of realism. And even in school, you know, I started with realism. We used to paint figures, Greco-Roman figures in plaster, and that's how I learned proportion and human anatomy. But to jump from that into abstraction, I had a hard time. So I did that jump here in Cebu because when I, after graduating visual arts in UP Diliman, I came to Cebu and started the shop, right? But on the side, I was painting. I was also doing my art. And I did portraits of people, and yes, they liked it. But then at a certain point, I said, how can I jump from realism to abstraction? So what I did was I learned meditation, yoga and meditation. And through the meditation, I was able to jump, to make the transition. So after when I was learning meditation, I learned how to look at people's auras. You know auras, right? So don't think I'm crazy.
Yeah,
but
it's another episode.
There was a time when I could see magnetic fields, the electromagnetic fields, that the heat that surrounds a person because of meditating for long hours. So I was painting that, and that's how I made a jump from realism. I said, "Oh, I'm gonna start doing your colors and your energetic body like this." So I would go into meditation, and my teacher for meditation taught me how to do that, to come into, to go into intuitional inspiration. And so 5 minutes coming out of the meditation, I would think of the person and I would see some colors. And that's what I painted. So my painting was called Soul Light Portraits. Portraits of people's soul light.
Interesting and a bit not weird, but fascinating in a way.
Eye-opening, I think.
I should meditate more. I used to meditate, but I should meditate more.
Yeah, but it was born out of the idea that all of us are forms of energy.
Yes, we are like all energy.
All the cells of the body are, you know, and that's energy, but it that's a form. But if you energy taking that form, and we are energy also made of cells and all that, and taking this form. So and the humans, because we have heat in our body, we have a unique electromagnetic imprint.
That we can't see that.
We can't see it. We can't see it. But you have things like Carolian photography and all these things that can detect it, right? So but that's mysticism, not related to design.
Yeah, interesting, also art and mysticism, they always go hand in hand.
I think the basic premise to that is really humanity, right?
Exactly.
Nature.
Humanity. We are humans. We are in a world of humans, so interaction of humans. There's no good design that's not based on that. We have to base everything on humanity, on us being human, being sentient beings.
Pertaining to humanity, sir, you mentioned earlier about this new rise of designers, right? New generation of designers. I want to tap on the mentorship side. How do you approach mentorship, or do you have mentees right now that you're teaching, or how do you manage that area? How do you breed the new generation of designers?
I was lucky enough to be appointed as one of the mentors for Philippine Design Competition in the past decade, or I can't remember, but you know we had a national. There were national competitions where, because I'm a member of the Fashion and Design Council of the Philippines, and that's that council includes people from designers from Davao, from Luzon, Visayas, and Mindanao. And the Mindanao, the Visayas part, I was one of the mentors. So I was very lucky to interact with young designers, because it's very interesting how they approach design. For me, it's always refreshing. And being a mentor only means that you have more experience, but doesn't mean that you're actually teaching them how to think, how to react to a design challenge, right?
Yeah.
You share your experience, but it's up to them to actually solve it. So in a way, I'm saying that apart from sharing your experience, you're also learning from the mentee. Because the way that they would tackle a problem would also be something that you can learn from. So it works both ways. So in a way, I don't look at a mentee as just a mentee. I look at the mentee as also a teacher.
Yeah.
So we're on equal footing. Except that I have more experience, so my experience might be helpful to the problem that he wants to tackle.
And what would be your, like, for the people who are looking for a mentor, what would be your advice for them if they're looking for a mentor? How can they find a mentor?
Initially, well, you can actually approach the designers, the more established designers, the seasoned designers, can approach them and submit your portfolio. Like, I'm open to accepting a mentee, an apprenticeship. But like I said, I don't look at a younger designer I look at a younger designer also as somebody to learn from. To share knowledge with, but also somebody to learn from. And but usually when the designer comes to me, I test, because I don't want to give the, you know, he has to be prepared, right? So if he knows the basics of the trade, so he has to know at least how to construct a basic skirt. So if he doesn't know that, then I would tell him to come back as soon as he know how to do that.
Yeah.
But if he doesn't have it yet, then because it would tie him down. It would also tie me down if he's not prepared.
Yeah.
Right? When the right teacher, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. It's that saying
that's
again.
That's a Buddhist saying.
Yes,
also.
It is. Yeah. So if you're not ready, then I just have to say it. But yeah, I like teaching because I also learn from it, and mentoring. I learn a lot from mentoring.
So how do you juggle learning, designing, and also teaching? How do you juggle all of those together?
I don't juggle it. There are no distinct lines between all of those. There's no, because teaching is learning. Learning is teaching. So making clothes, making a painting, they're related. Like my sensibility in color is translated in how I mix clothes. Right? In my painting. How I make clothes also affects the way I paint. Yeah, so like I said, you know, the harmony has to be there. If there's no harmony, that's when you begin to find a dichotomy. That's when when the trouble arises, when there's no harmony.
Staying true to yourself, everything you do somehow came from your extracted exactly from your soul, and you know.
Yes,
I can explain.
Yes, yes. It is.
Yeah, like your core.
Yeah, your core.
Right. Everything. It's something that's born out of your experience as a human being in the years that you have spent on the planet, and the relationships that you have had with people and teachers and students. It's something like that. That's what it is. So, and also you cannot really say that, okay, I'm a teacher, because I'm not only a teacher. You cannot limit yourself to just being a teacher, just being, like you said, he's an established designer. Well, yes, maybe I'm an established designer in the Philippines, but what about New York? What about, right? So you can't really put labels for yourself. And I think that works well, because then you become more fluid.
Yeah.
You become more, you will be able to act naturally and in any given situation, because you don't have a preconceived notion of yourself. Yeah.
Amazing. So, Sir Oj, we're nearing the parang final 10 minutes of, although we want to do another, you know, session for, you know, Buddhism, mysticism, yeah, and all that stuff, which we are thinking already now for the future. But we have one last question, and this is like your advice to people who want to break into fashion design.
Okay, the very first thing would be, if you really want to go into fashion design, why not? Like I said, no boundaries. You can be an architect, and then if you want to go into fashion design, you can. Learn the basic skills, the basics. You always have to have the skills and the basics. And then from the basics, you can build your own. You start from the basics, and if you want to find a mentor, it's good, because somebody can guide you with the experiences they've had. But eventually, you will have to become your own mentor. Right? And then when you become your own mentor, then you will be able to share experience also. Then you become a mentor to someone else. So it's really a cycle, an endless cycle of learning and sharing your knowledge. To be successful is to be diligent. If you want something, work on it, persevere, and if it doesn't work for you, then try harder. If at the end of the road you think that it's not for you, then it's not for you. Then do another thing that's good for you. So don't limit. You don't have to limit yourself to fashion design. You can be anything. You can succeed in whatever it is. So if your heart is in fashion design, if you want to be a good designer, make sure that your heart is in there, because your heart and your mind have to be in harmony. So when you're in fashion designing already, check your heart and your mind. Are you truly in it? And then success will come. Once you're in harmony, everything around you will be in harmony. Success will come. Wealth will come. People will see the value of your work.
It's really beautiful. I want to transfer my ship religion already.
You can visit. You're in Chuan Temple, Suraj. No? Yeah, you can visit.
Yeah, we have meditations on Thursdays. And we have Tai Chi on Wednesdays.
That's really good. That's really good to cap off this beautiful conversation. So yeah, thank you so much for joining our call for being our guest for today's show. And yeah, looking forward for another session probably.
Thank you so much for having me to share whatever I could to your listeners and to you.
That's episode 7. I hope you learned a lot from Sir Oj Hoffer. Special thanks to Attorney Ian Mantikahon, our sound editor. Denmark Padua, our graphic designer. This is your host, Chris Torregosa and Carl De La Cruz. Thank you for listening and see you in our next episode.